Welcome back to Keep It. This is Ira Madison. Hi, everybody.
Hi. Hello.
Oh, hello.
How are we doing?
Not great, bitch.
I know. It's almost a dumb question to even ask. How dare my white coworkers ask me how I'm doing over the weekend? What do you think? How do you think I'm doing?
I picture them lifting a little mug like this and asking, like tipping their head over it and asking you.
To be clear, the question was, did you have a good weekend?
Right.
Oh, okay.
So.
I love the influx of texts that have come. And I know some people have been like, what white people are y'all giving y'all phone numbers to? I saw someone tweet. But also, we have a lot of coworkers. And also,
Lewis
did not.
I don't know how many more white wellness checks I can take.
Check in. How are you doing? And I'm like, listen. Oh, no. Some of the people who have checked in, I obviously love. Otherwise, I would not have given them my phone number. well, there are some people who have it. But yeah, a lot of the like, how's it going? Last week, someone was like, what can I do? What should I be reading?
What should I be reading?
And I was like, girl, I screenshotted a page from Google.
I'm going to say, if there's one thing you can find on the internet right now, it's what you should be fucking reading.
Right. It's so annoying because I'm like, I don't want to give you a reading list. I do just happen to have one, but it has nothing to do with you. And like, you know, I got to share it. But right. Yeah, I understand.
I'm going to share a reading list later in the episode because yes, I do know good. That our listeners love a book list.
They love to read.
They love to read. I hope y'all reading all these books and not just purchasing them. And putting them on your shelf.
Collecting dust on the bookshelf. You better learn. You better crack that book open.
I was going to say that I felt like algorithmically, everybody recommending books, it's like they knew white people could only handle a few because like the same four kept coming to me over and over again. So it's like, I guess I'm reading White Fragility.
I'm no longer talking to white people about race is a big one too.
White Fragility is the number one book for white people this week.
That's their Bible, truly. Oh my gosh.
But also, it is Pride Month, and I need someone to write the white gay version of that book because the white gays are out of control, too. We're going to get into all that. But we've still got a show for everyone today.
Yes.
We have some conversations that need to be had about the past week. That we're going to get into. Mm-hmm. And we will also be joined by Bowen Yang of the Las Culturistas podcast and this little public access TV show called SNL.
Yeah. Little rinky dink project they got going on.
When people are talented and also friends with me, what's up with that? Very suspicious.
We'll be right back. Exciting news! Ahead of this year's elections, the team at Crooked has been hard at work trying to find the best ways for all of you to impact its results aside from casting your own ballot. Now they have an answer. Vote Save America's brand new Adopt a State program.
The Adopt a State program lets you directly support the work of organizers, volunteers, and candidates in the six key battleground states that will be most important to winning a progressive majority in 2020. And those are, of course, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Florida, and North Carolina.
When you sign up to Adopt a State at votesaveamerica.com/adopt, you'll get specific calls to action, things you can do yourself from home right now. That will make a huge impact on the races in these states. What state are you going to adopt?
Oh, gosh. Well, due to the Madonna credibility, I think I will have to pick Michigan. Mm. She does make fun of them an awful lot, and I feel bad for them. They just have a bunch of peninsulas. They're fine people.
I will, of course, be picking my home state of Wisconsin.
Will they take you? They'll take you back? Okay, great.
I'm going to start doing Keep It Wisconsin edition. Just me in a field with a cow talking about the election.
Lots of lakes, the occasional tall tree.
Anyway, you can adopt a state now at votesaveamerica.com/adopt. On May 25th, 2020, a black man named George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin, a white Minneapolis police officer in a neighborhood south of downtown Minneapolis. While Floyd was handcuffed and lying face down on a city street during an arrest, Chauvin kept his knee on the right side of Floyd's neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. 2 minutes and 53 seconds of that time occurred after Floyd became unresponsive. Three other officers participated in Floyd's arrest. All were placed on leave, but none of them were charged. And, of course, this came after the recent deaths of Breonna Taylor in Louisville and Ahmaud Arbery in South Georgia. And with all of these happening sort of one after the other and no charges immediately being brought to the officer, no arrest even happening, largely peaceful protests erupted across the United States, beginning in Minneapolis the day after the murder. 3 days later, protesters burned the police department in the 3rd Precinct, resulting in the National Guard being called in. It's estimated that up to 80% of protesters in Minneapolis and Atlanta, another city where a lot of protests were happening, particularly those instigating violence, were non-locals. This is reported, but of course there's been difficulty confirming all of this. We've now seen protests in Los Angeles, New York, San Francisco, globally, to be honest. And it's feeling a lot like Ferguson, but on a much larger scale.
Yeah.
The globally is sort of what hit me too, because I do remember traveling during that period and attending, I think, like a protest in London.
Yeah, it's painful. I mean, I have cousins in Berlin and Stockholm who are telling me that people are in the streets as well, protesting for Black Lives Matter. And globally, there is just a huge amount of outrage that we're all feeling. And honestly, I don't know how to process my emotions every day. It's a new whole set of grieving and mourning and figuring things out. And it's difficult to even balance the anger because another death will pop up. Another death will pop up. There's even another death that happened in Nebraska, in my home state, on Saturday, where a boy was shot by a white supremacist. His name was James Scurlock. So every day we're just faced with a whole new set of evils that we have to sift through, and it's overwhelming.
Right.
I would also say that it's, I think, even hard to reconcile your own feelings when you are then constantly processing new information. Mm-hmm. Like, you're never putting down the phone. You're never turning off the TV. And even if some of the same information is being reiterated, it's not like you sit with it. I mean, even just the footage of police seemingly on cue doing some of the most cartoonishly obvious shitty things I have ever seen.
Yeah.
Like, that alone is its own planet of insanity that you can't wrap your head around, let alone actual murder, let mm-hmm. alone what the fuck we're doing yes. in America. What, like, my understanding of America's, you know, is shifting or catching up to reality, I guess, is the correct answer. Yeah. But yeah, the layers of reconciling just never end.
Girl, the videos of, like, cops just, like, walking down the street, shoving people, hitting people with cars. I am currently not in Los Angeles. I drove out of the city because I needed to visit with a friend, and I'm also on deadline for a writing project. Not that I've been doing yeah. any of that writing, because I feel like from the minute I wake up, even more so than in quarantine, I am on my phone reading
nonstop,
just my timeline, and then you're just constantly reading, responding to things, finding out new things. It's horrific, but a friend is staying at my apartment in Los Angeles while I'm gone, and the text that he's just sent about, like, hearing gunshots, like the rubber bullets, and like finding yep. them on the street the next day, and then just like the curfews being instituted, seeing police strolling in and just like coming in on like huge trucks, like holding on to the side of them. I'm like, what kind of fucking police state have we devolved into?
Yeah, And it's just so utterly terrifying. I'm getting, you know, it's I, as a black person, I'm like, have to check up on all my black friends and I have to contact them and make sure they're okay, because a lot of them are in the thrush of it, or they're right in Brooklyn, they're right in Fort Greene, they're right in Koreatown, they're right in just any place in these major cities where they look outside and there's tanks outside, the National Guard has been deployed, they look up and there's choppers everywhere. Like, their home is not even a place of solace anymore. And I'm playing this game of having to figure out, my friends want to protest, they want to be in the streets, but I want them to be alive. Mm-hmm. It's very complicated, and you have to text your homies and be like, can you go home, please? Please? Yeah. It's so difficult.
It is hard, because you want to protest. So people should be protesting.
Yeah.
But when these cities institute these curfews, it's like, what can you do? You know, I have so many friends who've just already been like rounded up or detained because they've been out past this curfew, especially for Los Angeles, right? And I mean, I'm still getting those emails and texts, and I don't know what the fuck Garcetti is doing.
With these like up to the minute changes in the curfew, where it's suddenly like,
I hate him.
I feel like I'm in James and the Giant Peach, and Aunt Spiker just threw me in my fucking closet, so I can't go outside. Yeah.
Truly, truly, Garcetti being like sending out texts like, curfew was 2 hours ago. In case you didn't know, so you should have been home already.
Get your ass home.
Bend the confines of space and time and get home yesterday. Yeah.
And he's already been wholly embarrassing. You know, I mean, there is the homelessness crisis that we've talked about in Los Angeles before. We've had Nithya Raman on the show talking about the city council in Los Angeles before, and just how LA is basically beholden to the city council, and it's the mayor is sort of beholden to them too. But I don't know, this week, just like the goodwill that he built up from a lot of the testing and being ahead of the curve on the coronavirus pandemic in Los Angeles has all been eroded by one. Last week, before all this shit was happening, Garcetti was like, by the way, Los Angeles is open. Restaurants are back.
Yeah. Right.
Just go eat. And you're seeing like restaurants like the fucking Abbey open again. Were you that desperate to get to the Abbey to have some horribly made drinks with a stripper dancing near you in the daytime? And the other restaurants being open, and then all these protests started, and you know he must have been pissed, because these curfews now are ruining the restaurant openings that white people were angry and protesting for just a couple weeks ago. The stark contrast of all of those protests with these protests now have been so glaring.
Also, by the way, this is so obvious, but the intersection of corona with all this is also fucking cursed. Mm-hmm. When you watch these protests, or when you're at these protests, I don't know if people feel kind of muzzled by having to wear a mask or something, but to not see that also is like, first in LA recently, we had our largest single one-day spike in corona recently. And so to watch that, it's like, oh, now there's this other existential dread paired on top of it. Again, layers. I'm sorry to be so inarticulate. It sucks.
No, it's okay. We're all balancing all of our feelings and all of this, all the factoids, everything that we're learning every day. Like, I didn't even know that about corona, because I had forgotten we were in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. Completely had forgotten, because we're handling this other systemic pandemic that we've been dealing with for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's just the pain that I'm feeling, along with the way the music industry is pretending like they are protesting for George Floyd, the way other people are doing the performative activism, and then the conversations around performative activism, I can't fix everything all at once. We can't, and it's making it so difficult to focus. Fuck you, P. Diddy.
Okay, well, now let's talk about the music industry, right? Okay?
Oh.
So, speaking of the music industry, as we are recording today, we are in the midst of a blackout on social media. It was launched by Jamila Thomas, a senior director of marketing at Atlantic Records, written to industry colleagues, launching a hashtag, the show must be paused. And it was supposed to be labeling the day Blackout Tuesday. She and her partner in the initiative, former Atlantic Records employee Brianna Agumang, they made sort of a call to action asking people who work in music, entertainment, and show business to pause on Tuesday because the show can't just go on as our people are being hunted and killed. It was basically supposed to be don't be on Zoom calls talking about black artists, you know, and roll out plans and like don't be selling your music, don't be promoting it, etc. I guess it was supposed to be for non-black people to be quiet and amplify black voices today, right? But in the late hours of Monday night, all I saw was everybody's Instagram going to black and writing hashtag Black Lives Matter, which then clogged the Black Lives Matter hashtag on Instagram. And so many other people were just like putting up their black screen and then being like, I'm taking a break from social media. I'm like, this is the last thing you should be doing today.
There was nothing more frustrating to me than seeing someone like Travis Scott, who has not spoken on this in any way, just post a black square with no caption and probably go to bed happy that night. Like, it is the most, and it hurts at a sharper angle too, because George Floyd was a musician. Like, he really was a musician who worked with DJ Screw. He was a very, very notable hip hop person in the Houston hip hop sphere, not even underground. He was very revered and loved, Big Floyd. Like, it just feels like the music industry of all people are failing him. P. Diddy, Killer Mike, all of these people who should be speaking out, but are speaking up and saying the wrong things.
I understand the need for unification and wanting solidarity on social media, but at the same time, I personally feel like Instagram is a not optimal place for it, but a good place to spread actual information. Mm-hmm. I've seen lots of helpful links of I think I first saw, you know, a link about donating to the NAACP legal fund on Instagram or whatever. And that's just the kind of thing we're in this critical window where I think that space is better designated for that kind of stuff right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Particularly our Instagram stories, right? And you can share things very quickly, and Instagram stories are less clogged than a Twitter feed where you may follow so many more people than you do on Instagram. And if you follow the right people on Instagram, you're finding places to go. But yeah, there's a lot of people who flock to Instagram for unfortunately performative moments that feel like solidarity, but aren't really solidary. I mean, the Blackout Tuesday reminds me of so many other things that happen when something like this rolls around, you know? I mean, it was funny seeing the blackouts happen literally hours after every white person was posting the rainbow flag with a black fist in it.
Mm. Yeah.
I was like, go ahead, girl, give us nothing. Just some photos. Right. Get your photo up like Trump walking to a church and holding a Bible.
Yeah. You know, and also I would hope that during this time, while we're trying to change the way it is for black people in America, that we also change celebrity culture and we dismantle celebrity culture. only in the ways that there are some people like we've started to revere some of these celebrities as our gods, and then they start to speak and it's like, oh bitch, you don't know shit. You don't know anything about anything. And I hope that if they can't say the right things, that they're at least showing up with their pockets, because that's the only way they're useful right now.
Mm-hmm. What are you trying to say about Madonna? That she somehow didn't nail it with her weird post of her son dancing and then hashtagging Michael Jackson? What are you saying?
Hey, you, open your purse. That's basically what everybody has been tweeting to every celebrity all fucking week. And I've been surprised actually by the celebs. They're usually minor ones, not the mega ones who you don't really expect anything from, right? I'm like, you just donate some money, you know, like when Aubrey sent out some money,
don't
like
talk,
Drake,
Aubrey.
I'm like, okay, you know what? That's great. He didn't talk. He donated some money, and that's what we need to amplify other voices and to help people who need money right now. I've been surprised by some of the other like smaller celebs on Twitter who actually are just retweeting things, are liking things, and seem to be like taking in the content daily and behaving just sort of like the rest of us. I really love Kalani.
Yes, girl.
She was one of the first people who was like, what is this blackout, y'all? And mentioning the fact that a blackout day isn't going to really do anything when the music industry does not respect Black voices in general and doesn't treat them with the respect that it treats white voices and doesn't pay artists what they should be paying them. And the thing that she did point out, and also our friend Ray Sani pointed it out too, you know, a lot of people are tweeting at any celebrity, open your purse, this one. I think it's a big estimation about what people's finances are.
Yeah.
Because Kalani pointed that out.
Totally, totally. By the way, the internet is the worst resource for how much a celebrity is worth, too, which people consistently believe
in. I know.
Yes.
Don't look up a net worth. They're always wrong. They're always wrong.
Right. And Kalani pointing out that the money that you think artists have, it is the record labels that have them and the people who make these albums. They're the ones with the money. They're the ones that own the masters. They're the ones that get residuals. You know, the artists make money off of touring and merch and shit, and they're not making a lot of money off touring now. I mean, why do you think Gaga is dropping a jock strap every other week? That's how she's getting her money. You gotta get these gays to buy the merch. And not just celebrities, you know, it extends to other people, even like us, right? Because we're talking about money that we want to donate, and obviously you want to be held accountable and show a receipt. But after a while, I like showed a few receipts, and then I was like, let me cut off half of it, like, because one, I just feel. It feels weird to just say how much you're donating each time, to be honest. And you don't want other people to feel uncomfortable, like they have to match it as well, especially if they can't. And, you know, it's also like, I don't just have money lying around, you know? I have a family and other finances and things that I have to
support.
We've
all talked openly about our debt, our student debt that we still have looming, you know, that's constantly in the background. And it's this, I'm writing this line too of, I agree with you that that's a difficult thing for me to even figure out. But also I'm trying to remind myself that there is an importance in transparency right now, which I know you've done because you've posted it all in the first place. But every time I'm like, should I do it? Should I do it? I think about maybe that could light the fire under someone else's ass to take their the only important black square out of their pocket, which is the wallet, and to donate. So
on that same token, like, when I donate, like, I personally, like, haven't just posted the receipt. And I feel like the reason for that is, it's more a fear of being called a virtue signaler or something. You know, it's like, but it's like, get, like, in a way, like, I think now is an okay time to just get over, like, the egotistical part of
get
this.
Get the
just,
fuck over it.
Just post it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in my case, I know that you guys have probably seen that I've been trying to raise money for David McAtee, who passed in Louisville, Kentucky. And every time I want to post that we've reached a new goal or that we have, that we've gotten access to the certain celebrity, whatever, to raise awareness, I get worried that people are going to think that I'm doing this for a vanity project or for something like that, and that you're worried that people will think you're making this about you. But you also have to move past that and maybe even allow them to think that so that you can help these funds get raised or you can help awareness be raised. It is a, this is a very transformative time for all of us. I mean, I'm becoming more radicalized during this time, more involved with community organizing, something that I wasn't as much concerned with prior to this.
At the end of the day, social media is nothing but virtue signaling.
Yeah.
I mean, whether you're virtue signaling that you are doing something good, the very nature of posting a photo of you somewhere or tweeting that you're doing something is signaling to other people that you're doing something, you know? And if I can be performative about marathoning normal people all week and watching these Caucasian people have sex, very well. Paul Mescal is a god. You know, you can also post that you're donating this money. And honestly, the people who will sit at home and wonder if you're raising money for the right reasons, I mean, honestly, who gives a fuck about them? Because you're raising the money.
Yeah,
truly.
Truly.
Also, additionally, like, if I see that one of my good friends has posted for a cause, like, I already feel bonded to that person anyway. So, like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, to me, I naturally feel like, oh, I should go and join them. You know what I mean? Like, there's just something social about that.
Definitely. Definitely. And especially thinking about the fact now that I didn't realize how large our platforms had gotten, because as much as this is a job and this is something that we do for people's entertainment, I had normalized it. I had normalized, like, these are my friends. We just talk shit on a podcast. But no, we have a opportunity and I think a duty to share this information and to be vigilant right now.
Yeah, I think that's really sort of hard to grapple with, too. I mean, Lewis can speak to it with me, right? You know, I mean, from starting Keep It in 2018 to sort of now, it is still just sort of weird thinking about the amount of people who will listen to it. And, you know, like us wanting to, that's why I'm providing a reading list a bit later too. You know, it's just like people are listening and you should be speaking on any platform you have. And I think that was the nature of the Blackout Tuesday too, right? You know, you are amplifying other voices. And I just hope that people are looking for things to do. We talked about not texting your Black friends, asking what to do. You know, like, look for resources yourself. They're there.
And again, I'm going to say, I feel like social media this weekend has been particularly rad in the universe of how you can sort of have at your disposal, like, real tools. Like, there are people who've written about this for years. Something that drives me crazy about this particular moment and something that's extra vexing is, by this point, we have had so many extremely popular entertainments about this subject. You know what I mean? Like, we have, like, not just Get Out, not just Black Klansman. There have been tons of books, tons of movies. And I feel like, in a way, POC feel so much like they're reiterating the same things that have been reiterated at, like, hyper pitch for the past 5 years. So I feel like the tools are there, you know, for white people specifically to do this work on their own.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I feel like this is the absolute last time any white person is allowed to be like, you know, I felt very embarrassed for not speaking up before, but now I'm using my voice. I'm like,
yes,
bitch, if you're saying that, like, in 2022,
we need to talk.
When we're going through some shit like this again, I'm pulling up to the house. drop the Addy. I'm pulling up.
I'm posting. I'm taking the phone. I'm saying something for you. This is embarrassing.
Well, I think also, by the way, like, there is a reticence among people to speak up now because it pulls into focus the fact that there's absolutely no reason they shouldn't have spoken up before.
Yep.
So there's an embarrassment in speaking up because obviously this is nothing new, even in regards to, or especially in regards to, and I'm sorry to bring up the name, but Trump. Because he is only giving you what he has promised, right? So to comment on him now for the first time feels somewhat insane. Even seeing Taylor Swift post, it's like, I'm glad she did. And she's now, you know, used her gigantic platform a couple of times, you know, admirably. But there is always that layer of, come on now, you know?
Right. And you also have to remember that this is what we were talking about when we would have episodes about Taylor Swift not speaking up, right? At the time, so many people being like, you're asking so much of this pop star, et cetera. And now I think we realize that I'm glad people did, you know? I'm glad people spoke up because now she is using her platform. And it should be embarrassing that she didn't speak up before. And we're all embarrassed about a lot of things that we've done in the past, but the way to get over that embarrassment is to keep it moving, you know? Do what you need to do, feel that embarrassment, either apologize for it or deal with it in yourself and keep moving on. Like, I'm embarrassed by things that I've done before,
yep.
You know? I held a fucking rally for Pete Buttigieg.
That you did.
We all
I
make
remember.
Mistakes. We really all do make mistakes.
Truly behind the curve of most other Black people in America. And now I've seen the light and I can look at his ransom note tweets during this time and be like, wow, he really ain't saying shit, is he?
I know. His ransom note, his like random text looks like he put it in a word generator tweet.
It is like he is just tweeting out things from a word a day calendar. This is the America that should be America. If we want change, we can change. Ellen DeGeneres tweeting that shit too. A lot of empty rhetoric right now from a lot of people who really just shouldn't know better.
I am actually grateful that, again, that their stupid is showing, that their inability is showing, their inability to speak on anything other than what they do is showing. But here's another thing that I wanted to actually talk to you guys about, was that I have friends who are posting, their white friends who are posting their little mixtapes, posting their new project they're working on, posting some of their screenplays. And I'm very of the mind that we shouldn't be posting anything unless it helps or heals during this time. But content creators, artists, performers are all having to sift through and figure out what it is that they can add to this narrative right now. And, you know, content feels kind of frivolous to me right now. And but I understand entertainment is how some people stabilize their mental health. So I just wanted to know, like, what do you guys think about people who think they're adding levity to the world right now, but might just be posting some bullshit?
You know, I think James Baldwin has talked so much about the role of the artist, especially in times like these. And I would argue that not everything that sparks change is the obvious social justice route. You know, I think that, for instance, a film like Moonlight isn't about social justice on the surface, right? But in showing images of Black love and queer Black love, it sparks change and is a powerful statement. I think that now is the time where, if you aren't a person who is going to be making an Ava DuVernay documentary 13th, then you can spark change in other ways. You know, I know that myself as a writer, just the things that I care about and want to write about are going to maybe spark change in a sense that they are telling stories that we haven't told before. You know, I don't think Daybreak, the Netflix show that I was on, did a lot for social justice, mm-hmm. but there is something to be said about writing queer love stories for a platform like Netflix and, you know, pitching out and creating a queer Black character and putting him on screen in a way that he hadn't been put on screen before, you know? So I think that there are ways for artists to be helpful. And I think that's ultimately up to, one, the artist, and two, up to the consumers, you know? I mean, post your shit. If we look at it and it's trash, we're going to call it out, right? but I think a lot of people, you can have, you know, sort of the wherewithal to know whether or not you should be posting about something specifically. Have some discretion, I guess. If you're an artist and you're creating things, like, you're not stupid,
I would hope.
Yeah, Aida, I'm of two minds about that, which is to say, I think there's a Venn diagram here between, you spoke specifically about laughs, mm-hmm. between comedy and truth telling, and I feel like I would err on the side of just statements that are true more than statements that are outright hilarious. Let's say if I'm talking about what you post on Twitter. That said, I do think there's a version of like a shocking laugh or a unexpected laugh that I think can lodge valuable information into people's heads too. But
a Jabuki tweet, for instance.
Oh, yeah. Perfect example. Perfect
Jabuki's
example.
A good example.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where like it's so harsh and so, but also so fresh, you know, like it feels like it speaks to the moment in a way that a lot of other social media doesn't. So you're right. I think, Ira, you brought up the word discretion. I mean, it's hard to ask for that in these times.
It's hard to
certain
use.
People, but yeah.
And I'm sure we'll talk about this with Bowen Lewis, but, you know, I am very glad that Lady Gaga dropped an album last weekend because,
Jesus Christ. I mean, like, to even have the slightest, I hate using the word diversion in this case because it makes it sound like, oh, you're putting everything off or whatever. But if, like, your brain needs to have something else in it in order for you to like function, I guess. So for that reason, it was nice to tune into Lady Gaga at the end of the day. Yes.
Also, it's one queer dance music. So what do you think queer people have been doing for decades, you know, visiting discos in the 70s, you know, at the height of homophobia in America and racism, and it music has always been an escape. And I think the people who are adamant about not listening to music now, or telling you that listening to something like Lady Gaga's new album is a diversion, are one, they're doing their own kind of virtue signaling, right? Letting you know that they're being quote unquote important right now. And it also just ignores the fact that one, we're human beings with 24 hours in the fucking day. Please do not expect me to sit in front of a television screen watching destruction all day.
Yeah.
Because that is not good for anyone's psyche. And so many therapists will tell you that racism is trauma. And
it's stress.
Black people are traumatized in America. Queer people are traumatized in America. And to continue to process that trauma and take it in every day, it doesn't serve you. It doesn't serve the people around you. Go listen to a fucking album.
Yeah. Go dance. Go do something. It's like the onus is on you to continue to look up history. And you can go down. This has happened so many times that I could be learning about riots for the next 10 years and it wouldn't stop. We're here, and then you get the information, you can contextualize it, and you learn about Rodney King, and you go to the Detroit riots in 1967, and then there's riots before that. So this is just endless material. You need to have an out, and I don't consider it music and art to be as a form of escapism as much of as a form of release.
You know? Of course. Stonewall riots. There's a riot down the block. Every month.
I forgot I was gay. I forgot I was gay, bro. This is just so much. Pride happened and I was like, oh, I like girls. Oh, thanks for reminding me.
Like, I mean, girl, same. I haven't been in the vicinity of a dick. So.
nary a pussy around. It's so sad.
It's a good reminder that this moment is important, but this moment is also not abnormal.
Yeah.
These things have happened in America for centuries. These things have happened in the world for centuries. And if we just stopped making any sort of music or any sort of art ever, we wouldn't have any.
Yep.
You know? It's weird to say, well, we shouldn't be listening to this now. We don't have the time to listen to it. We didn't have time last year. It's actually weird that you thought we had time last year to listen to it. There's never a good time for any of this shit because there's always something horrific that's going on in this country.
Also, if you were a white person telling me how to spend my time right now, you could eat a dick. You could get so blocked. You could get blocked so quickly. So quickly.
Also, this is an especially interesting time when we have not just Lady Gaga's new album, but Dua Lipa's new dance album. And I think one of the great things about being a 33-year-old white queer person specifically is picking a side in these imaginary battles. So
you love that album. Are you Dua Lipa side then?
You know what?
You're Dua Lipa.
We'll get into this with Bo. In terms of personality, I'm way more Lady Gaga. But in terms of track by track quality, I'll probably go Dua Lipa in this case. These are complicated philosophical questions. You can't just stress me out like that.
Well, you're absolutely wrong. And we will talk about that bit. Anyway, I think we have exhausted ourselves. Mm-hmm. If you are looking for some way to help, there are plenty of resources like Campaign Zero and Reclaim the Block, which are policy initiatives you can advocate for. Reclaim the Block is Minnesota specific and it advocates reallocating police resources for communities. We should definitely be defunding police departments. We'll be talking about that more later when we get to My Keep It. And search for some GoFundMes. We'll provide links on the Crooked website with the episode when this has dropped, but you know, GoFundMe's for George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, the Minnesota Protester Bail Fund, the Brooklyn Protester Bail Fund, Atlanta Solidarity Funds, and then you know, other organizations like the Bail Project, the Black Visions Collective, NAACP Legal Defense Fund. So there is no shortage of places where you can open your purse.
I want to add to that. A friend of mine, Matt Whitaker, a brilliant comedy writer, said something that stuck with me, which is pick something you're passionate about, pick a way to donate, and then think of that recurring donation as an investment, you know, something you are adding to constantly, as opposed to just like, oh, can I pay for this? You know, there's something edifying about finding something you can consistently donate to.
Right. The Good Fight had its season finale, so cancel that CBS All Access subscription.
It's over. What are you going to watch, Madam Secretary? You're done. Get off CBS. You're fine.
When we're back, we'll be joined by Bowen Yang. Is the host of the wildly popular Las Culturistas podcast and just wrapped his first season as a cast member on SNL from the comfort of his own home. Here to kick off Pride Month with us is Bowen Yang.
Wait, I'm kicking off Pride Month with you?
Yes.
This is our first episode of Pride,
it's
bitch.
It's June 2nd, boo.
Oh, parade float, Bowen Yang.
Yes. Grand Marshal of Cupid, Bowen Yang.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll allow it.
No. Wow. It's an honor.
So happy you're here because Matt Rogers has been here three goddamn times.
Yes.
I think four, actually, at this point.
Talking.
And we've had enough.
We have to keep inviting him back until he gets it right, and we're waiting.
That's, well, because, I mean, what's the split between when he was a guest, between him being a guest and him filling in as co-host?
Right. He filled in as co-host, I think, like...
Twice?
Two times?
Yeah.
Ooh,
two times.
Cute.
Has been a guest, and then... also came back with Dave.
Mm.
So four times he's been on the pod, right?
Yeah.
There's some like
it's disgusting.
Disgusting. There's some like Cara DioGuardi like connection there where it's like he auditioned to be on the he auditioned to be sort of like a mainstay but couldn't hack it or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Cara DioGuardi is one of my favorite stories, by the way, in pop culture, which I think I've brought up before because she was brought on to be a pro to be totally objective, like an executive, and then Paula left, and then they made her be Paula and like hug Simon all the time.
yeah. She got a note.
Tug is Henley.
Yeah. Ugh, Simon's Henleys.
Gross.
The even grosser part of Simon was the many years that we fully had to put up with this fake story that he and Paula Abdul were just like fucking, constantly doing skits about how they were attracted to one another.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Who needed that?
They did go for sketch comedy. And then Heidi and Tim did that on Making the Cut. That was sort of taking up that mantle. And by the way, I didn't want that mantle taken up. So, problems.
Dang.
What culture have you been into lately, Bowen?
I've been very film-averse lately. I don't know why.
I can't sit for anything that long anymore.
No, me neither. Oh, no. The last movie I watched was... In Bruges, and what an awful film.
In Bruges is exactly like when I was in college, what would appear in a frat guy's favorite movies. Like it would maybe be the second or third line, but it wouldn't, yeah.
Because it had just
after
come out.
Boondock Saints.
Yes.
Truly. Smoke and Aces. Yeah.
Smoke and Aces. Oh, God. In Bruges came out, like right around... Like I think towards the end of high school for me, and I don't know, I just didn't go to a school where like people were into film, like that wasn't like a clique or anything. So I watched it in college, and I was like, this is pretty cool. Like, oh, this Martin McDonagh guy, yeah. And then watching it now, especially after Three Billboards, it just like it puts it all into focus where it's like, oh, this guy is like obsessed with little people, and he's obsessed with calling people fat and like. I'm not digging Martin.
Oh, right.
I was reminded of how bad he was.
Something I have reconciled with recently, though, is that I don't like the projects he picks generally, and I specifically don't like his roles in most movies.
Yeah.
But I do think Colin Farrell is a really good actor.
Agree.
What was he doing in Widows? What was he doing in Saving Mr. Banks? But I do think... Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. he's got a sort of talent and a rage befitting of, like, you know, a 5'3" Irishman or whatever he is.
He's 5'3"? He's short?
I don't know how short he is.
He's got to be.
He's gotta not be. Tall. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
His proportions feel
I
that
truly
way.
Love Colin Farrell, and I do agree that the good projects are few and far between. Phone Booth is great. Maybe one of the best things Joel Schumacher has done besides putting nipples on Batman. So there's that. And also that insane vulture profile of him as well.
Where he was like, oh, I have fucked 25,000 people. You're talking about Joel Schumacher, right?
Yes. Joel Schumacher, who, for those listening, if they don't know that he is gay, and which you should have known from seeing Batman and Robin, his vulture profile just goes full faggot. Truly talking about how many people he is just fucked. And like, okay, wow, the 90s in Hollywood were swinging if you were a gay director.
Yeah, for sure. I was going to say, I feel like vulture profiles and interviews are like among the most, I don't know, gay candid. Like the Noah Galvin interview was very interesting.
Cultural reset.
It was. It really was. I don't know. I really liked the Noah one. I like Jeremy O'Harris's. Like, I don't like. It's E. Alex Jung at New York Magazine who like does a lot of like the ones that I'm interested in. And like, it's
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I like it. I like a gay vulture profile. That's all I'm saying.
He gets the girls talking.
Yes.
Like
Bowen is referring specifically to a Noah Galvin interview. Noah Galvin used to be on the show The Real O'Neills.
Yes.
And he eventually filled in for Ben Platt in Dear Evan Hansen, mm-hmm. but he gave this interview that he rescinded somewhat afterwards, probably mostly pressured by the network he was working for, but he talked about being gay, and it was very candid in a way that gay actors routinely don't feel they can be.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, calling out Bryan Singer.
Yeah.
Specifically calling out Colton Haynes.
That was tough, but anyway. I just love a good vulture interview. And then I was going to say, oh, I'm my friends and I are just obsessed with how Evan Hansen's just date each other. It's so cool.
Yes.
Right. There's two pairs of them.
Two pairs.
He filled in for Ben Platt, and then he filled in for Ben Platt.
Oh, God. What could be worse than that comment?
I love it. Oh, Ira.
Ira, you know what my big memory from like the great before is truly, oh, this was last Pride. This was the Ty Sunderland party last Pride that we were both at. And I remember just like, I mean, I was rolling my fucking head off, but I remember posted like some Instagram story of Ty playing Who Do You Think You Are by Spice Girls. And I just remember, this is just quintessential Ira to me. But the text on it was, I don't know a better DJ. I'll never forget it. Anyway.
That's from World Pride?
That's from World Pride, yeah. Yeah. Were you in town for that? Yes, you were. I saw you.
Yes. That does feel like an eternity ago. When I think of World Pride, which was, of course, a joining of all the countries in the world who came together for Pride in New York last year. I've never seen anything like it, and I suspect I never will again.
Oh, yeah.
When I think of that time, I think of Madonna's Madam X album having just come out. So, unfortunately, that space is dominated by the song God Control, which is barely a song, but very long.
Very long. Is Madam X I Don't Search, I Find?
Correct. Yes.
That's
good song. That's,
great song.
Yeah,
great song.
Also, I wanted to point out that Bowen just called the time before this the great before.
The great before. I don't know.
Is that what we're picking? I like that. It's kind of like when Jeremy O'Harris came on and gave us the Quar for quarantine.
The Quar. Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Now we have the great before for anything prior to
take it or leave it. Take it or leave it. Aida, where were you last take Pride?
This is a funny thing. I was actually at World Pride in Brooklyn when I was in New York, and it was my first and only Pride. So I'm fine. I'm good. That's all I need right now. That's all I need. Like, I don't want another Pride situation that I can compare to World Pride.
No.
Like, I'm good on
of
that.
Course,
so
of course.
Things are fine.
It really felt like a gay gladiatorial event. Like, you would walk down the street and be like, well, there are the competitors from Slovenia. Like, just everybody. You know?
And we're all meeting up at the McDonald's in the square or in the village. Yeah.
I truly do remember before we went to one of those Pride parties, Lewis, I think we all stopped at a McDonald's
right
in New York, and we're just like scarfing down food before we went and did drugs and drank. And truly, I did not need McDonald's in my system at that point. But what are you gonna do?
I believe that was also my idea, so I believe I can be considered culpable.
Yeah. You love a McDonald's. Truly travel anywhere with Lewis, and he has a sixth sense for knowing where a McDonald's is.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Right.
Sniff them out.
Yeah.
A Haley Joel Osment of, Mickey D's. Yes. Bowen, I was going to say, the first time I ever watched you perform, I think, was at the Duplex in New York. That's now 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think of what you do on SNL now. I think of Las Culturistas, and I wouldn't necessarily describe it as the same thing.
No.
And I was wondering how your sense of humor has evolved and has had to evolve since you've joined SNL.
I don't know. Like, I was trying to hack into the UCB sort of system, couldn't do it, and then ended up just, like, staging and producing little shows in Brooklyn where we would do, like, an all-gay male sort of staged adaptation of a Sex and the City episode. Or you do, like, a court show with two drag queens being the plaintiffs. I had no sort of plan around like what this was gonna like lead to. I remember like back then, like this is 5 years ago, being like, oh, I'd be very happy just being staffed somewhere as a writer. But then I was doing sketch with Matt and our friends from college. And then that just kind of like just very inadvertently like laid this foundation for like, oh, this is like going to be like what your calling card is. I'm using such horrible language right now. But then I would like dabble in stand up. I was like patching together all these different disciplines, and I really had no vision for like what it would become. And then getting hired as a writer on SNL was sort of a weird fluke. But then it was just about using that first season as a writer to just like develop this like pitch brain for just like jokes, for just jokes, because that's sort of the currency of any comedy show, but especially SNL, where it's like you are modulating jokes onto existing sketches from other writers, you're coming up with your own stuff. So I don't know, I feel like I spent that first year there becoming like an actual writer, because I never self-identified that way before. Mm-hmm. And then I think that kind of laid a very good foundation for being a cast member, which was helpful in just thinking of premises that I could be in. Because like before this season, like I never thought of things in terms of like Asian stuff. Sometimes it'd be queer stuff and gay stuff, but to have to like write towards like a general audience, and to have like Lauren sit next to you during dress rehearsals and be like, let's, you know, cut to this person sooner or whatever, and just like slowly drop little bits of like wisdom. Because I mean, for everything that people say about Lauren, like he's seen it all, I think, and mm-hmm. it's sort of cool when he just kind of like gives you a cryptic riddle that you have to figure out. I feel like the transition between like doing random shit in Brooklyn to spending a year sort of in the trenches or whatever at SNL was very helpful in terms of like crystallizing everything.
I just want to say that the impression of Lauren you just did reminded me of Alfred Hitchcock in two ways.
Oh.
One, it specifically just sounded like him, like the way his jaw moves. Yeah. And then secondly, the speaking in cryptics.
Yeah.
He would talk to actors and like give them Cockney slang to figure out or something. But there's something with Lauren in particular where he's a man of few words, but you are supposed to deduce something from him.
It's always as you leave the room that he like drops something really crazy. I remember the second year I auditioned before I got hired to write, I had to fly to LA because that was when Colin and Che were hosting the Emmys and Lauren was out there producing it. But I had to fly to LA, meet Lauren in the Polo Room at the Beverly Hills Hotel. And then we talked or whatever. And then I got up to leave. And then Lauren just goes, and Bowen, there's an improvement. I've noticed an improvement. I was like, thank you. And then I walked away. Like he was talking about like the way that I improved like from like the season before. And then I remember one time I was just not happy about a profile that someone had written about me. And then I left his office after he sat me down and like, I don't know, shared some showbiz story from like the 70s. And then he was like, and Bowen, I'm glad you're here. Like he's just like, he just like dropped something that like kind of, I don't know, is a sealant on the whole conversation that I think is like kind of nice. I like him. I like
Lauren.
That's
so interesting. Yeah.
The only time I've ever, I think, like, seeing Lorne in the wild was that Emmys, right?
Oh, yeah.
I remember specifically my friend Sam and I, we snuck into Colin and Che's Emmy party.
We literally
walked around to the other side of the Roosevelt where the entrance to the party was not there. And there was a black security guard. And I remember going, hey, yeah, you know, like we went out for a cigarette. Is this how we get back in? And he was like, oh, y'all was in the party. And I was like, yeah. He was like, just come on in.
Yeah.
Great. Very good.
Seeing him hold court at the party, just sort of sitting there like the Godfather, with everyone, you know, sort of having fun around him and going to pay the respects. It was like the scene from The Godfather with the daughter's wedding, you know?
He
probably ordered someone's death there, and I loved it.
Probably.
You know, it's probably hard to put a finger on it, but what is it that you miss the most about, you know, getting to be with your castmates and getting acclimated to being at SNL now that we're all in the house?
Yeah, I just miss the moment after you sort of, okay, let's say like on a Friday night, you're in the building or you're like on a pre-tape shoot until like 2 a.m. and then you have to come in the next day at noon to start running through stuff. I miss coming in on a Saturday after everyone's, yeah, like zonked out and everyone just checking in each other when they're sort of at their, not lowest low, but they're like in their valley of the week and they're about to like, and this includes like writers and like people on the floor and everybody like, and like we're all about to work towards a common goal that's going to like end no matter what in 12 hours. So that's cool. But like, you know, that's when you get like your little check-ins with people. And that's when like someone will be like, come into my dressing room. Let's talk. I don't know where you just check in and have like honest conversations about things. And I had a lot of moments like that this season that were nice.
That sounds beautiful and precious. And I need you to take every moment and conversation you've had with Kate McKinnon and distill it to a conversation that I can read.
Yes.
That's all I need.
Okay.
That's all I need.
this is like the quintessential Bo and Kate conversation. There's only been a handful, but, there's a play that Kate and I both saw that we both didn't like. I'll tell you guys offline what that was, but we bonded over dislike of a certain play. A very long, long, long play.
I think I got it.
I hated that play too.
Yeah. And then, oh God, I'm like spilling a lot of stuff.
Yes, girl, go.
Happy Pride. But no, one time Kate and I were on the floor for something, and then we just started going, this is so obnoxious, but we started going on about fun little wordy words, like verbose words that we like to whip out every now and then. And like, we were both like, ooh, what are some words like, and like phrases like, liminal space. she's a freaking Columbia girl, and I'm like a pseudo intellectual in that way where I only signal my intellect by using words that
as a fear tactic.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah, I understand.
But now I'm trying to move away from that because I'm reading the books that I'm reading now that I have to read are just like the author flexing their vocab, and I'm like, I don't like this.
Mm-hmm.
So I needed to like do that less, I think.
What's always interesting to me about Kate McKinnon is that she is not a writer, correct? In a way that like many other SNL cast members like end up writing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, she writes. She's like
oh, she does. Okay.
She writes, but in terms of like the visual of like someone like clacking on a keyboard, she's someone who like will sort of like sit back and like pitch a joke like this, or just like stare blankly into space, and then just be like, "What about this?" You know, she has a writerly brain in terms of like generating stuff and pitching stuff. There's such a weird unspoken thing at SNL where it's like the writers have to drive and be at the keyboard and the cast members shouldn't. And it's like it never makes sense to me. Like Ego and I will write together sometimes and we're both just like, well, we both, like last season I would write for Ego and I'd be at the keyboard and she'd just sort of sit back and pitch stuff. But now it's like we're both on cast, but now we both have this fun balance of just like being at the keyboard, driving it at the dashboard to just like cut stuff, move stuff around. And it's fun. I just feel like there's no reason for everybody to not be on the keyboard. That's all.
Right. Also, something fascinating about SNL to me now is like you and Julio Torres, another fabulous gay writer, creator, work together a lot. I don't think there's ever been a like queer battery of creators at SNL before, has there?
It used to be it would be like James Anderson, who has written Gays in Space and The Californians and like Secret Word and Gemini's Twin. Gemini's Twin was
love Gemini's Twin.
Gay fucking culture. Gay fucking culture. Because you know what? Because whatever. Like the first few weeks of the of COVID, like the producers were like, "Hey, I guess we're just gonna record some stuff from home and put it on YouTube and Instagram of cast members talking about their favorite sketches. Like, what would you write about?" I was like, I immediately knew. I was like, because the first sketch I ever saw was from the first SNL I ever saw, which was Charlize Theron in 2000, and that was the, I think, the first Gemini's Twin, where they sang Whack Whack on TRL, and
this is a fake girl group featuring Anna Gasteyer, and it's very in like neon colored Destiny's Child outfits.
Yes. And I just remember that because it was the first sketch after, because I looked this up, it was the first sketch after the monologue, so it was the first sketch of the show, and then that it just like imprinted onto me. And so, and then James wrote that. And then Matt and I were at SNL, Sudi's first year as a writer, to just visit her at a show. And then we like crept upstairs and watched the show from the offices. And then James was there. And then James came out and was just this like lovable gay pope who like was just chatting us up about Drag Race. And we were like, and then Matt had the instinct to ask him. He's like, I don't know why I have this feeling, but did you have anything to do with Gemini's Twin and Deep House Dish and like all these gay sketches? And then I said, and did you have anything to do with Gays in Space? And he was like, whoa, yeah, like I wrote all of those. Like he's sort of been the person like blowing the dog whistles for like decades at this point. Mm-hmm. And like, I don't know, he's the best. But yeah, I mean, like, but he's been there. I think he is looking to maybe move on to something else, but he was still there last season. This past season, we wrote a sketch with RuPaul that got cut for time, where it's just me and him doing the scene from Dynasty between
Dog. Oh, in the mine.
Know. Yeah, yes, in the mine.
You know I stand that scene.
Ira. Oh my God. Yeah, so James, but like James is like the source for me, at least, and for Julia. Like, he and Julia work together so often. They wrote the Barbie Instagram sketches, if anyone's seen those. And then Julio and this guy, Jeremy Byler, wrote Wells for Boys.
Fabulous.
Love that one.
And so, yeah. So Julio and James and Jeremy have sort of, I'm sure I'm missing a couple writers.
It is so great to know the person who wrote, yes, all those formative, just like queer sketches that I loved. Before you go, gay rapid fire, you did bring up talking about Drag Race with him.
Uh-huh.
Are we team Jada? Are we happy that Jada won?
We were team Jada from day one. I mean, and then she's the only one who had like multiple like origin stories, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Like the thing about her, I mean, like, but this wasn't even on the show, but her talking on Instagram about how like growing up she didn't have nice things, so she had to develop this like mindset of making the nice things for herself. And then at the finale, her talking about her grandma and watching like Liz Taylor movies with her, and how her drag is supposed to like be a tribute to like that time with her grandma. It's just beautiful. Cause then Crystal and Gigi were great, but then Crystal's narrative was I'm weird, and Gigi's was I'm confident. But Jada's was like, I love making things and I love looking glamorous and beautiful. And those lip syncs. To Get Up by Ciara, are you kidding me?
The great minute she got off, it was amazing. The minute she got off the couch to that song, I was like, that song was a gay moment.
Yes.
That I stand years ago from the fucking Step Up soundtrack.
And like to do that from her carpeted living room, like gorgeous.
And she's from my hometown. And so so seeing the video the next day of
the cars,
like cars doing
the
a procession
beautiful.
Down a street in Milwaukee that I recognized, I was like, it was so great to see like the Black community and queer community in Milwaukee showing up for her. Mm. I was like, that's so insane. Right? I'm like a hometown hero. I'm like, yeah, Gigi winning would have been nice, you know, like, but it's like Brooklyn, you know, it's New York.
Yeah.
It was nice seeing a queer drag queen Midwest bringing that home.
Yes.
It made Drag Race feel sort of more important again.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
And finally, I did see you Saturday at Ty Sunderland's Chromatica Zoom party.
You looked amazing.
Thank you.
You looked so good.
I had one of those like crystal face masks that I saw Billie Eilish wearing one time, and I found I found it on sale at opening ceremony when they were going out of business and had to buy it.
Beautiful.
What are your thoughts on Chromatica?
I love that there's no ballads on it.
Totally
yeah.
agree.
Yeah.
Fair.
Yes. I think I still need like a couple more listens of it, I think, to like form like a fully hardened opinion on it. But I really like it. I really like it.
It feels to me like a couple of times she hit the anthem generator button in order to create some of these things. Yeah. They blend a little together for me.
The anthem but like, generator button.
But there are certain songs. I love A Thousand Doves, which is the gayest metaphor ever.
So funny. Mm.
And I love...
Babylon.
Yes.
Babylon. Okay, which is definitely a tribute to not just Vogue, but songs like Too Funky by George Michael, that time when we were obsessed with supermodels and strutting down runways.
Yes, yes.
Which is great. That said, it's literally a song about Babylon, and she wikied maybe two facts about what Babylon is, including that it's old.
What is a 16th century smile? Is she talking about like the Mona Lisa or something? What does that have to do with Babylon?
I think she said 16th century BC.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
Oh, goodness. Got
it. So that's a little bit closer at any rate, but you know what? Probably not exact.
No, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Hearing her say that's gossip is the high point of the album. Besides
that's funny. Yeah.
Chromatica 2 into 911.
Yes, so. Yes, yes. You're about to say 9/11. I want Gaga
to drop.
I want Gaga to release a 9/11 song.
It's time.
I haven't healed quite yet. Exactly. Cap my healing.
Yes. No, it's great.
Yeah. It feels like art pop, but edited to me. And I really like it more and more each time I listen to it. So
yeah. There's a meme where it's two men carrying a baby and the text is, I love my two gay dads. The baby has Chromatica, the album art, as a head, and the dads have Art Pop and Born This Way as heads. Which I feel like, yeah, that works. That tracks.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here, Bowen.
Thanks for having me.
Excited
y'all.
To have you.
Thanks
on
for
Keep
coming
it.
On.
I love you very much. I hope everyone's keeping well.
Yeah, we're trying. And honestly, yeah. I always love that Las Culturistas and Keep It drop on the same day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How often do you guys get screenshots from listeners who are like, wow, Wednesday gay podcast drop? Like, that's just our covers stacked on top of each other.
Yeah.
It's great.
Gay podcast sweepstakes we're all a part of.
Yes, yes, yes. Happy to provide.
Thanks, Bowen. And as I just said, Las Culturistas drops on Wednesdays, same day as Keep It. So listen to them both on the same day. Listen to Keep It first, but then listen to Las Culturistas.
Yeah, Las Culturistas is only an extra treat. You must start with Keep It as a rule.
Before we get to Keep It, I wanted to provide our listeners with a reading list of some books that can help them understand America's history of systemic racism. And there's also some books that just generally illuminate Black lives. They're from artists and writers that I admire. And there's some books that I don't think that we've mentioned on the podcast before. Obviously, you know, we've mentioned books like The Warmth of Other Suns, and we talked about White Fragility earlier in this podcast, so you've heard about those, but I want to provide a list of some books for you all to read, also some films that you can watch, and I'll provide as well some Black-owned bookstores where you can order these from. Do not get them from Amazon. Bezos has enough of our coins. So first I would recommend Audre Lorde's, Your Silence Will Not Protect You, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race by Rennie Edo Lodge, They Can't Kill Us All, The Story of the Struggle for Black Lives by Wesley Lowery, If Beale Street Could Talk by James Baldwin, and also The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, Ferguson, Palestine, and the Foundations of a Movement by Angela Y. Davis. So You Want to Talk About Race by Igioma Oluo. Some films I would also recommend are Barry Jenkins' adaptation of If Beale Street Could Talk, Rise. It's a David LaChapelle film about the creation of crumping, which was actually a dance born out of protest and police violence responding to it. The documentary LA 92 about the 92 LA riots, and a film called The Interrupters, which was from PBS. Anyway, I think that is a small list to start with, and some places that I could recommend you get these books from are places like A Different Book List, Ashe by the Bay, Key Bookstore, Mahogany Books, Esawan Books, Uncle Bobby's Coffee and Books, Hakeem's Bookstore, Harriet's Bookshop, and the Lit Bar Bookstore. There will be a list of these Black-owned bookshops on Crooked.com. Just go to Crooked.com and look under Keep It, where this episode will be listed along with the episode. There will also be this book list and links to where you can order these books from. We'll be right back with Keep It.
And we're back with our favorite segment of the show. And yet again, the only part of the show with a name. So it feels awkward that any other part would be our favorite part. It's Keep It. I've elected to go first since mine is extremely minor. We're going to move on to my learned colleagues momentarily. Keep it, as we do every year, to Ivanka Trump, who has tweeted on June 1st, the beginning of Pride Month, "Less hate, more love. Hashtag Pride 2020. Here's my feeling about Pride posts. You have to know three gay people in order to make one. That's my feeling. And those gay people cannot be either Peter Thiel or Jafar, who I know are in her little black book. So moving right along, queer people are no slouches to realizing who is an actual queer ally, though I guess shamelessness is the hallmark of the entire Trump family. So I'm not surprised, but I am done with it and annoyed.
To be fair, she's in the White House, and I feel like the White House is a queer space since it's where Reagan let Rock Hudson die.
That's right, yes, which was and Nancy Reagan matched her indifference with the China, so it was really beautiful. But anyway, moving right along,
since you had to keep it to like a white woman who is doing the most, before we get to our serious keep it, there are a couple other white women who've just been wild this week. One.
Yes. Multiple keep-its this week.
One. I don't know if people saw the other day because it was sort of buried in the news, what with everything that's going on, of course. But Blake Lively and Ryan Reynolds donated money, you know, to like a bailout fund, which, thank God, very grateful that they did that. But they donated money because they realized just now, 8 years later, that it was wrong of them to get married on a plantation.
Oh, we're still after that? Wow. Yes. That was a problem of theirs. Oh, wow.
Yes. Still after that, because apparently just now in 2020, they realized that that was wrong. People have been dragging them for that for like a fucking decade. And it took this week for them to be like, oh, that's what you meant.
Well, now rioting about it.
Racism.
Even soup plantation bowed out at this point.
Yeah. Soup plantation.
And maybe one of the best blank is over parties I've seen on Twitter since has Justine Sacco landed was last night's very late into the evening takedown of Lea Michele.
Please spill.
From everyone, including cast members on the show, to extras.
Yes. So Lea Michele, a few days ago, did a tweet about George Floyd. Hashtag Black Lives Matter, etc. Last night, one of her co-stars, Samantha Marie, discovered this tweet and quote tweeted it with, in all caps, LMAO, remember when you made my first television gig a living hell? Because I'll never forget. I believe you told everyone that if you had the opportunity, you would shit in my wig. Amongst other traumatic microaggressions that made me question a career in Hollywood. Can I talk about the beauty of the phrase shit in my wig?
It is four perfect syllables. There's no space. There's no air. It's music.
Like, just telling a woman on set, bitch, I'll shit in your wig.
I can't wait to steal that and use this after we get out of our fucking houses. That's so good. That's so good.
And then what happened was a avalanche of former cast members throwing shade at Leah and chiming in. Alex Newell quoted it with the Drag Race gif of Coco Montrese going, get her, Jade. Amber Riley tweeted a gif of herself drinking from a mug, sipping the tea. Someone named Dabier, who was on one episode and played an animal husbandry companion, I guess. That's what it said on IMDb. Wrote, girl, you wouldn't let me sit at the table with the other cast members because I didn't belong there. Fuck you, Leah. And like, I saw Melissa Benoist just liking all the tweets.
Oh, I didn't see that.
She didn't comment, but I was going to Glee cast members pages to see what they were saying, and I saw that in her likes, she was liking all the tweets, but she didn't say anything. Truly, truly just a wild, fun evening. And of course, it brought up stuff like the time Lea Michele was like very sad that she didn't get cast in West Side Story because she learned Spanish for the role. She's also not Latina. And someone reminded me, there's an old Gawker post from 2010, and the video's not there anymore, but apparently at the Emmys, Billy Bush presented her with a cupcake, I guess for her birthday, and she called it ghetto on live TV. So I guess a long time come and keep it to Miss Leah Brunette Ambition Michelle.
I'm excited for the potential buddy comedy here with her and Constance Wu. Not exactly the same universe, but I do want to see them tangle.
I don't know if this makes things more or less likely, but another keep it to the tweet that Ryan Murphy had the other week, too, where he was talking about wanting to reboot Glee with, like, Lea Michele and Ben Platt.
Oh, yeah, that was very strange. And he also added something about how if he had only had access to this kind of talent at the time or something. I felt it was accidentally shady to the cast he had, but I'm not sure.
I personally don't want to see Ben Platt reduce himself to being in Glee. There.
I think that's definitely fair. Aida, what is your keep it this week?
My keep it this week is, of course, on a somber note. We are in the middle of what feels like, you know, and is one of the most historic moments that I've lived through and maybe even of the past 20, 30 years. So a lot is going on. My keep it goes to the Louisville Police Department. Just as we all know, the National Guard has been deployed in many major cities. And we're also in the midst of watching incessant videos of cops brutalizing protesters. And it's very easy to normalize that and become desensitized to it. But I just wanted to raise awareness about a killing that happened on June 1st, early in the morning, far, far away from where the protests were at. David McAtee was fatally shot in Louisville, Kentucky, around midnight on June 1st. So we've lost another black man's life, and it's another death that we're not even talking about and don't have time to talk about right now, and it's unfortunate. So the Louisville Police Department had their body cams turned off. And conveniently, last night, the only other location that could have potentially had surveillance footage of David's murder was on fire. And no one really knows the cause of the fire, but it was a wrongful death situation and a black man is involved and cops are involved, so we can only assume. But I just want to tell everyone that we should remember to be outraged right now about his death, because this man was a provider, a business owner, a community member, very, very well loved and revered in the Louisville community. And he was killed yesterday. So his family is now going to have to pay for memorial services, funeral services, what we can only assume will be a wrongful death case and litigation. So we have to put them in a situation where they can have enough money to defend themselves and bring justice to David's life. So I'm urging you guys to go to the GoFundMe page that was started for him. It is now being given fully to the family, so they will be the sole benefactors. But we have to raise money for them. Systemically, we live in a world where Black people are not actually provided the resources that they need to fight cases and to bring justice to their family and to situations where we are killed. So donate what you can and if you can. And even if you can't, like we were talking about earlier in this podcast, use donating as a practice for you and for investing in your community that you live in. I know that we're all donating to a lot of Black-led organizations right now that are focusing on ending police brutality, but I also urge you to give money to this cause as well. We have to give his family as much relief as we can, as much calm as we can, and we have to play our part. Justice for David McAtee.
Yeah, and if you can't donate, you know, obviously share the GoFundMe, you know, amplify it to your friends and followers who can donate. I learned about it through your tweet initially, Aida, and I'm very grateful that you did tweet about it and started the GoFundMe, and I saw how much money it has raised so far. So thank you so much for doing that.
We're about to hit $250,000, and that's like unheard of, especially for someone who I've organized small things, and of course the GoFundMe is easy to make. It's not that noble, but I didn't really think that I'd be able to help people or inspire people. So you just have to do the thing. Do the thing that you're scared to do, and hopefully you can create any increment of help during this time. But yeah.
And Louisville, you know, also as I mentioned before, the city where Breonna Taylor was shot, you know, and still hasn't been any justice for her, right?
Yeah.
And then there was that dumb story about how the police chief of Louisville was fired because of the body cams, and then it came out that he was a month away from retiring anyway. So.
And he still got his benefits and his pension. So really, he just like fast forwarded his way to Florida, like
took a vacation.
It's all very, very painful.
but you know, speaking of all of this, and you know, there was another death that we haven't gotten to talk about on the show too. It being Pride Month, I wanted to shout out Tony McDade, a Black trans man in Tallahassee who was shot. Just thinking about these police shootings and thinking about these police states that we see us living in, thinking of Los Angeles, where the police chief had the gall to say George Floyd's death is also on the hands of the police and the protesters. And then he had to walk back that statement, and seeing our mayor just standing behind him and the way that he props up the LAPD. My keep it is to police, but specifically our industry, the entertainment industry, in how police are glorified, how we have basically been trained to revere police officers and see them as the heroes in every fucking story, you know? I think of all of us growing up watching shows like NYPD Blue, you know? Law and Order specifically. We're constantly seeing a program from Dick Wolf about police, you know, and feeling like we are empathizing with them and really just making them sort of this everyman in American storytelling constantly. It feels like propaganda. It feels like a fetishization of crime and non-white people as criminals. And I think that television writers, screenwriters, novelists, like, people really need to take a good hard look at what sort of content we're making going forward. And I think one of the things that really needs to go is crime dramas that center police officers. Yeah.
I think specifically something that bothers me about this, now that it's been brought to my attention, because I truly have never thought about how persuasive this kind of programming is. These Dick Wolf shows specifically are comfort viewing. You watch them because the police are in control and they have to deal with twisted minds and twisted people. And the fact that it's in these people's hands is supposed to be pacifying, you know, to viewers. Like you watch that show and just veg out, right? Like there's not much thinking going on. It's just the right people are dealing with this. It's in the right hands. And that really is creepy. It really is not analytical, and it's not fair to the people that the justice system routinely fails.
And specifically as a Black person, growing up in an era where Black comedians were often cast as cops in films, you know, so they could be funny avatars for institutional racism and just sort of like a nice face to put on police. And they always played a character who was like bucking against the system, right? And proving that if there's one good cop, they can persevere, and that there's always a white police chief who trusts them and like will eventually help them seek justice. Or in shows like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, where there's always like a Black police chief, there's always a fucking Black police chief in film or TV that I don't think translates to the real world. And it's just to show that, you know, like upward mobility is possible for Black people in the police force. And isn't it great to look at a Black person on this side of justice? It feels like it's progress, but it's not really progress, because as we've seen this week, Black cops don't get rid of the fact that the police is a system created, you know, out of slave catching and terrorizing Black communities. And just placing a Black cop into that atmosphere does nothing. You know, we in Atlanta, it was Black cops who were fired and put on leave and desk duty for just being violent with protesters. And it's like, there goes your theory that, you know, a Black cop is going to be a better cop, you know. And I think through seeing like Eddie Murphy, Martin Lawrence, Will Smith, you know, Chris Tucker, Whoopi Goldberg, you know, like playing these cops, we're sort of desensitized, and we're trained to almost Clockwork Orange style to think that like these people are the people who protect us. And that's it.
I was actually thinking about the movie Black and Blue, and if I need to see it now.
I need to watch all of Shades of Blue, if that's something I know about me, but I won't speak for anybody else here.
The amount of episodes of The Closer I fucking watched.
That secretly has like 9 seasons, too.
Yes, yeah. Brenda Lee fucking Johnson. And then I remember, like, towards the end, there was a storyline about, like, whether or not she had coerced a confession out of someone or put a witness in danger. And you're always supposed to be on the side of the cop when something like that happens, right? It's always like, mm-hmm. Oh, you know instinctively that they didn't use force when dealing with this witness. They didn't do anything wrong. And you're waiting for them to prove themselves to a system that's trying to take them down, right? You know, like, why is internal affairs always the villain in these shows?
Yeah.
Anyway, let's keep it this week.
Yep.
I wish I could go shit in a cop's wig.
I think you're going to find an opportunity. I see it for you. I'm excited. I'm
if
worried.
If not, I'll curate it so that it can happen.
Well, thank you again to Bowen Yang for joining us. And this has been Keep It. We'll see you next time. Keep It is a product of Crooked Media. Caroline Reston is our producer. It's Caroline, like the princess, the one you don't care about. Our editor is Bill Lance, and Kyle Seguin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn and Nadine Melkonian, for filming and editing our video content every week.